Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Wells Tower, the author of a first book of stories called Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Now, the publishers sent out a pamphlet prior to the book that has two earlier versions of a story that appears called Retreat. And by this token, it becomes quite clear that you're a very industrious rewriter, and I wanted to ask you how you developed your process.
Oh, I suppose out of the ordinary self-loathing that most writers feel about their work when we confront it later, you know, with the collection, it was, I suppose, 8 years of short stories that I assembled into a large manuscript and then sent out in 2007. And, you know, so sitting down and looking at the edits, you know, it was like a slightly more mature writer having to confront the work of a younger writer and figure out what to do with it. And so for that reason, I wound up swinging lots of wrecking balls at the earlier stories, and then also some of the later ones that, with the early stories, there was something kind of simple and primitive and occasionally kind of lovely about them. But I was trying to bring a bit more sophistication to the early stories. And then with the later stories, I think I was trying to bring a little less cleverness to them. And so that was what happened with Retreat. Uh-huh. The first draft just seemed a little glib, a little clever, and I wanted to install a larger heart in it.
Can such a thing be done?
It can certainly be attempted. And I mean, I think that's all we can do. That was really what I was trying to do with that story, though, just to make, you know, there are two brothers in the story, and one, at least in the first draft, was the kind of more sympathetic narrator, and the older brother was kind of a punching bag in the story. And I thought it would be a more morally complex story if the older brother had a fully furnished interior and we could get a sense of his mind and his heart a little better.
You say that in this pamphlet that your editor then helped you write down from the, by now, perhaps too emotionally sympathetic range that the character had attained in Rewrite. And I wondered how often it seemed to me that you had a natural gift for a kind of, I don't know how to put it, word magic.
Well, thank you.
That the and I feared somehow as I looked over this various group, three versions of one story, how often do I get to see that? My days in a writing workshop are far behind me. And, you know, I often tell people who want to show me manuscripts, I wouldn't. I am so long since I've seen things raw. You know, by the time something gets to me, it's been through usually workshops, agents, editors, all kinds of revisions, and I don't know how to read a first version anymore. But I had the feeling somehow that editing was turning these stories minimal in a certain way and that your own verbal impulses were more maximal.
I think that's probably true, that I have a real giddiness with language, that it's easy for me to make myself drunk on words. And that for me, I can easily lose track of a story simply by indulging too much in the pleasure of sentence craft. And I think that there have to be two rival impulses at play when I'm writing. One of, you know, the sort of linguistic exuberance, and then another impulse days or weeks later where I go through and really try to make sure that the language is in honest service to the tensions of the story and of the characters.
Well, you know, you'll pardon my terrible presumption, but I just have the feeling, this is pure instinct, that when I'd come upon certain kinds of passages, like the description of a coral reef in the first story, Brown Coast, and other, you know, not strictly on the path of narrative things, mm-hmm. but where the words just seem to be having a wonderful time with one another. This seemed to me to be the natural gift, and that the terser story is a more fashionable contemporary story, you know, a minimalist guy's story. But I had the feeling that these stories might have been edited into a resemblance with other male stories, and that the storyteller's yarning gift was somewhat more ornate.
Sure. Well, actually, none of the... There are really no radical edits that came from the editors. That most of the big stuff came from me. And I think that the minimalist impulse is an interesting one. But, you know, I admire a lot of sort of more minimalist sorts of fiction writers, you know, the early Dennis Johnson stuff or, you know, Carver, Hemingway, or any of these guys. But to me, it seems crucial that the with minimalism, you're minimalizing a larger, bigger story, that it's an abstraction from a looser, more sprawling kind of yarn that you're then trying to condense into a very muscular, intentional kind of draft. But I think with writing that sets out to be minimalist, a piece of writing that sets out to be the tip of the iceberg but none of what's beneath will be a failed story. But often, I think even with the later stories, I tried to get away from what felt to me like cheap tricks sometimes in my writing. And, you know, I think at certain points I felt myself, if I lost grasp of the soul of the story, I would delve into sort of highfalutin wordcraft. And, you know, the later stories are a little bit more minimal. Leopard, which appeared in the New Yorker, is a very spare kind of story.
In that story with a coral wreath in it, eventually toward the end of the story, there's an odd poisonous fish. It turns out a sea cucumber that looks like a turd that's been eating rubies. And you say, wow, you know, I want more of them. And it's each story has its patch of narrative extraordinariness. And I wondered about those tensions in your work between the wrought sentence and the direct one.
That's a great question. It's, I suppose my feeling about short fiction, I think I have a very old-fashioned kind of attitude about the short story, that I really like short stories that are discernibly stories with beginnings, middles, and endings, and ideally some sort of turn toward the end. And when I sit down to write a short story, I'm very conscious of having a story to tell and fulfilling that obligation to the reader. I mean, my own private reason, I think the reason why I first started writing was just a pure enjoyment of language and the thrill of, you know, writing these curlicues and riffs and sentences that please me. But I suppose I feel as though there's a certain amount of... You have to tell a certain amount of story to buy yourself credits with the reader so that you can do what you really want to do and you know, fulfill your you know, most exuberant, self-indulgent pleasures as a writer. But so for me, there's a certain amount of narrative I feel as though I have to deliver and directness that I have to deliver before I can really go and riff and just sort of sport in the language.
It seemed like the title story was a place where both could happen simultaneously.
Sure. The title story was a very strange one. You know, this was a story about kind of mid-career Vikings who have lost their appetite for slaughter, and they're out on their final siege. And yeah, that one I sat down to kind of write it as a joke. I thought it'd be kind
of. It felt at first, you know, like it could have been a sketch that John Belushi would have started.
Right, right.
You know, you see the Viking helmet and, you know, yeah.
Absolutely. And that was the genesis of the story, that I thought this might be kind of funny to write a kind of, you know, what is it, dirty realist or gritty realist kind of story, but set it in a Viking siege. but then the nice thing that happened with that one was that it got away from me and it kind of acquired its own momentum and its own emotional weight and direction, and kind of wound up going in a place that I didn't expect it to go. It sort of has one of the more large-hearted, sentimental conclusions of any of the stories in the book. And
well, not only that, in addition to its romping and marauding aspect, all these guys in different ways have concerns about the wives they've left behind that are much more tender, in fact, than the other more contemporary husbands in the stories that precede it. You know, almost as if, you know, this one, you know, has to get back home because his wife is waiting. The other has lost his wife and is looking for one and hopes to find one in a siege, and maybe he'll be able to capture her and take her home. Well, never mind if she never feels like talking to anyone again. there's a certain kind of, Ice Age gentlemanliness.
Sure, sure. And a kind of, I think, a kind of nakedness of longing in that story, that these guys are sort of very committed to their relationships, and that they, you know, look at you know, romantic love as a kind of salvation in the story. But I think with that one, there's enough ugliness, you know, again, you know, to think about buying credits with readers, that I think all the slaughter and nastiness in that story bought me a certain amount of room for sweetness.
Well, yes, because some of it, I forget what it's called.
The Blood Eagle.
The Blood Eagle represents more than ugliness, a kind of ugly joke, a kind of can you top this in grossness. So it does double duty as part of the kind of BC or comic book world. What is the Viking in the comics? Is it Hagar?
Oh, I guess you write Hagar.
There's a certain kind of I don't know. Let's laugh because this is too crude.
Sure, and actually that thing was the genesis of the story. Supposedly that was a real practice that Vikings would do, and. So the story for me sprung out of this idea. I was talking with a friend and I just thought, man, the Vikings really did this? You know, if I were a Viking, I think I would just say, it's too complicated and gross. Let's go have a beer somewhere.
Give the simplest version of this and then we'll take a break for listeners to recover.
Okay, yeah, this is quite awful. I hope whoever's listening is not about to eat anything. But yeah, supposedly the Vikings would do this number after they had beaten somebody into submission, where they would make these cuts in the victim's back and haul the lungs out through the cuts. And then when the victim dying would breathe a little, the lungs would kind of flap and it would look a bit like a pair of wings. And they called this the Blood Eagle.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Wells Tower, author most recently of Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Wells Tower about his book of stories, Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned. Now, do you have a passage that you like to read as representative of the work?
Well, I suppose maybe the final couple of paragraphs in the Viking story. I think may work well.
No blood eagles.
No blood eagles. Absolutely not. So in this passage, the Vikings are returning to their homeland after having done this terrible siege in Northumbria. And Knut, the close friend of the narrator, who is a widower, had taken this woman back, who he sort of abducted from a farmer that they met. And you might think it was a good thing that Knut had found a woman who would let him love her. And if she didn't exactly love him back, at least she would, in time, get to feeling something for him that wasn't so far from it. But what would you say about that crossing, when the winds went slack and it was 5 long weeks before we finally fetched up home? Knut didn't hardly say a word to anybody, just held Mary close to him, trying to keep her soothed and safe from all of us, his friends. He wouldn't look me in the face, stricken as he was by the awful fear that comes with getting hold of something you can't afford to lose. After that trip, things changed. It seemed to me that all of us were leaving the high and easy time of life and heading into deeper waters. Not long after we got back, Jarf had a worm crawl up a hole in his foot and he had to give up raiding. Knut and Mary turned to homesteading full-time, and I saw less of him. Just catching up over a jar turned into a hassle you had to plan 2 weeks in advance, and when we did get together, he would laugh and jaw with me a little bit. But you could see he had his mind on other things. He'd gotten what he wanted, but he didn't seem too happy about it, just worried all the time. It didn't make much sense to me then what Knut was going through. But after Pila and me had our little twins and we put a family together, I got an understanding of how terrible love can be. You wish you hated those people, your wife and children, because you know the things the world will do to them, because you have done some of those things yourself. It's crazy-making, yet you cling to them with everything and close your eyes against the rest of it. But still, you wake up late at night and lie there listening for the creak and splash of oars, the clank of steel, the sounds of men rowing towards your home.
Wells Tower, reading from the title story, In Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned. That sense that they're leaving behind their, you know, their green age, is it one you had when this book of stories got done? I know you're working on a novel.
No, that one actually is a very early story, and you know, the sentiments in the story really share nothing with my own life. I don't know where that ending came from. That it's one that's kind of been picked out by a lot of people as one of the more significant passages in the book, but it just. After all the horror, somehow that it just kind of issued up out of the cracks in the story.
Animals seem to enlarge these stories on a regular basis. A moose in the second story, the fish in the first, a cat bringing in a bird that looks like the bird wants to become a prostitute.
Oh, a half-cooked eraser with dreams of becoming a prostitute. Yeah, talk about a mixed metaphor. Gosh.
But it's wonderful. You see, that's what I... those are the places where I sat up, you know... Say it again?
Oh, I described a pigeon embryo as looking like a half-cooked eraser with dreams of becoming a prostitute.
But also perfect because the younger girl in the story... who is brought this corpse by her cat, is dealing in a certain way throughout the story with dreams of becoming a prostitute.
I suppose that's true. I had not brought that in as a deliberate metaphor for her, but more, I think with the pigeon corpse there, the cat delivering the pigeon corpse, I think it hit a theme that shows up a lot in the story, just people looking for comfort and safe harbor in different places. You know, in that case, a young girl with her cat. And then that quest for safe harbor delivering ugly things sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. But I think also that the story ends with a kind of cat and mouse game between an older man and the young girl.
Sure.
They're both, in a sense, playing at each other, and equally so, the game will extend to the young girl's father.
Sure.
In a fairly horrible way. But always the, it seems to me that animals appear in stories as to presage the human.
I suppose that's true. I hadn't really thought of myself as somebody with zoological preoccupations one way or the other. In fact, it would not have dawned on me that I was, you know, had this sort of naturalistic impulse in the fiction. You know, I think that has really, you know, it's come from someplace in the subconscious that...
Yeah, well, that's an interesting subconscious when you say that, because one of the characters in the first story is a veterinarian, and kind of the figure for the story is that there's something that can get thrown into a natural paradise that will emit gases and poisons and kill everything right. beautiful around. So right. that little sea cucumber is what the story is about
right.
for this
right.
man.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, the animals in that story, it's, you know, I mean, I think it shares a kind of common tone with the pigeon corpse in the story Wild America, that it's...
Well, also with the moose.
Sure. I mean, though the moose...
There's a moose who gets shot but already has some sort of poison or disease. So as they cut him apart, all the meat is turning. And, you know, this is, it seems to be, again, like the dreams of the character going bad
right.
as he starts to hack them into place.
Right, right. It's very funny. I mean, that all of these animals, I think maybe with the exception of the pigeon embryo, these were all sort of stories that had come to me. You know, the moose story was kind of a fully formed anecdote that I heard from somebody in Alaska, and the story about the man with his aquarium. That was an anecdote told to a bartender friend of mine, and it just seemed so perfect. So it wasn't as though I spun all these things out of whole cloth, but obviously for some reason, when I heard these stories, they made it into my bank of you know, spare parts for future pieces of fiction.
Yeah, but somehow, again, you know, take it for what for what it is. That dog, is her name Beatrice?
Sure.
Right. Is again, in a way, more plangent and memorable than some of the people around her. The cucumber, the dog, the moose, the cat.
There's the lizard and the
lizard,
in the carnival story.
Yes,
sure.
The salamander. I just suggest to you that some of the things that you call your digressions are in fact the thing you give the story's energy to.
Well, that's great to know. Then now that I'll pay attention to it, I'll
be
incapable
Bambi.
Of doing it anymore. Yeah.
No, I just think that some of the things we gather and embellish with are some of our strangest and most beautiful effects.
Sure.
And I remember, you know, seeing in Wuthering Heights these kittens near the fireplace, black, and you couldn't tell the difference between them and the soot. So Emily Bronte says it looks like the coal, the soot, was coming to life.
That's beautiful.
And you think to yourself, well, who can forget that? Now that she has that, she better build Heathcliff big and scary and unforgettable because she has cats made a call. You know? In other words, I think the details are the challenges to make the center bigger and better than the details.
Sure. Though it's a challenging assignment. I feel as though my stories are so, they're very much assembled from details. You know, that often when I sit down to write, it's a kind of laundry list of details that I've got that I'm looking to find a home for. And, you know, always the challenge is finding a way to, you know, animate all of these Frankensteinian elements that you know, we hope we can work into a short story.
You said at the beginning that revision in certain ways was a response to the self-loathing that one feels when looking at a story and seeing its mistakes or what can be better. Have you ever gotten to the point where that loathing went away?
That's a good question. I think I did a lot of really brutal, crazy revisions to the collection, and I think some of them were motivated more out of that frantic desire to be a better, smarter writer than out of a real editorial intelligence and thinking, you know, what is this story capable of and how can I make it fulfill its intentions better.
So you weren't kamikaze.
Yeah, I just sort of thought, oh, it's just terrible. I'll just write a whole new story and it'll be a better story and you know, I won't have to worry about that old troubled draft. And with some of the stories toward the end, I had kind of gone a little crackers, and I think I started to scare my editor a bit. but after about a year and a half of really brutal revisions to the collection, I think at this point it's a volume that I can stand behind, that there's nothing in there that fills me with a cold horror that the manuscripts did. And that's a nice feeling.
I've been speaking with Wells Tower, author most recently of Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, Wells, for joining me.
It's been a great pleasure.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.